Welcome to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories. So for this episode, I'm going to cover climate change denial. And before I get started, I need to make it clear, and as a disclaimer, that anything I say during this program is my own opinions. It does not reflect my employer or the clients of my employer. Now, I will be delving into some areas that there'll be moments where I'll be a bit vague on what I'm talking about because I work with many of these industries that I'll be discussing. I'm under a number of confidentiality agreements. So what I can talk about, I've researched, and if there is public knowledge on the subjects. So if there's areas that sounds a bit vague, I have to be because of the nature of my job and information that I've been privileged to have access to. And of course, I don't want to create any real problems with the various companies that my employer deals with. So again, I apologize in advance if there's parts, but in general, much of the information that I'll be presenting is public knowledge, publicly available, so it shouldn't be too bad. But just in case, there it is. So the concept of climate change denial and this idea that global warming is not occurring, it's actually became quite interesting that through the research I was doing, what I was finding was a lot different than my earlier show about HIV denial. The major difference is that much of what we're being told as being, at least from the conspiracy side, is actually all made up. And you'll begin to, I'll get into this here in a little bit, but just a little quick history about environmentalism in the United States and in general around the world, but I'm going to focus mostly on the United States. The earliest environmental type activities were usually centered around the larger cities and dealing with sewage and animal waste. As the Industrial Revolution began to gain speed, many of the large cities, which would attract the industrialists who locate there, and then, of course, everyone who, the employees and people who wants to work at these places, began to migrate into the cities, mostly in the northern cities, cities like Chicago, New York, Detroit, Pittsburgh, all these larger cities in the north, of course, created problems with clean water, clean streets, and so on. Cholera, typhoid, all sorts of diseases were cropping up in these cities. And when it was determined that it was the raw sewage being dumped right into rivers or right into the streets, coupled with horses, that their manure was creating a serious health problem, many cities undertook different approaches to clean this up. Cities like New York, who had begun digging their various aqueducts to draw water further away from the city, and Chicago, which took the radical approach, kind of a twofold. If you're familiar with the city, there's the water cribs that are 2 miles out into Lake Michigan. These were built so they could draw clean water as opposed to the sewage that was flowing in from the Chicago River. And when that was being threatened, the idea was to change the direction of the Chicago River and building a lock and dam at the mouth of the Chicago River, and then a canal to dump to flow the waste into the Illinois River, ultimately reaching the Mississippi and New Orleans. These were major engineering attempts at cleaning these cities up. And oddly enough, while these methods worked, other technologies was becoming available. The automobile in the 1900s actually helped eliminate the need for horses in the city, which of course ended the manure problem. Unfortunately, as we know today, automobiles are now kind of have their own issues in pollution or its creation of pollution, but I'll get into that in a little bit later. But it would be the turn of the century, the beginning of the 1900s, when the many naturalists and environmentalists like John Muir, the Audubon Society, and so on, and along with the industrialists like Henry Ford, had lobbied and got Theodore Roosevelt, who was also a kind of a naturalist, outdoorsman type, and convincing him to support legislation to set aside various sites. This is where our national parks come from. And the government had began various programs to protect open lands, establish parks, national parks. There was, this is also coupled with a kind of a health craze that was kind of sweeping the country, coming out of Germany and England about creating open spaces and so on. And, clean water and so on. So the United States began to close off open spaces or regulating open spaces, again, as an attempt to basically offer areas that were free of pollution, dirt and so on, to open off open spaces for recreation. And this actually had a benefit to Henry Ford, because with the automobile becoming very popular amongst the United American citizens, parks gives them some place to, so they can buy their car and drive to. So it actually, it pretty much worked really nice for everybody. But this was kind of the extent of environmentalism, at least until the late 50s, early 60s. And this is when a number of scientists and writers and so on had began to recognize that there were issues with many of the products that we had become accustomed to. The Second World War, the First World War and the Second World War, but mostly the Second World War, gave us these great new products like DDT, improved asbestos, all these nice, at the time, very, very useful, very efficient, very, very, user-friendly products. Unfortunately, with DDT, it was starting to be realized that this was harming wildlife, particularly birds, and bird populations where they had sprayed DDT was eggshells were thinning and all sorts of problems, which raised a lot of awareness that many of the chemicals we are using may not be as safe as we thought they were originally. Asbestos is another material. It's a natural material. It's an excellent insulator. Doesn't conduct heat, so it worked great in products like home insulation, various tiles, building products where we need to have 2 or 4 hour fire stopping ability. So, but it was realized much later that this asbestos was hazardous and first taken off the market. And of course, if you watch any type of TV, especially late night TV, if you were exposed to asbestos in the workplace, there's a fund now set up to pay for your medical expenses. But then there was the real push or the real kick to the modern environmental movement was the Cahoga River fire of 1968. Now, the Cahoga River is the river in Ohio that passes through Cleveland. And along this river, there's a number of industrial plants that had been dumping their effluent into that river. And oddly enough, this river catches on fire quite regularly. Actually, the worst fire on the Cahoga River was in 1958 that did almost $2 million worth damage, but 10 years later, only about $50,000 worth of damage. But it did get the attention of Time magazine, and a major article was written about this fire. And the main one of the comments in this article was, this river does not flow, it oozes. Now, this particular article and this particular fire was the catalyst to create the Environmental Protection Agency, a number of other departments, to the water watershed. I think there was the Ohio EPA. There was the U.S. the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and a few other agencies that came up out of this to basically clean the rivers, clean the air, clean the lake, and try to push forward more responsible industrial practices. Now, the main push of this legislation focused mostly on municipalities and industrial pollutants. Many of the earliest regulations looked at what was being released to rivers, the air, into the landfills, and most of the country began to regulate general releases to the environment. States like California began to look even closer and began to regulate the chemicals that would actually be used or released. But now what this meant was that many of these industries began to having to look at what they were doing and determining the best ways of dealing with these chemicals that they were dumping straight into rivers, sewers, and so on, and find ways of containing, capturing, even possibly reusing and selling them. And at least in the early 70s, now for most industries, what they were dumping into rivers and landfills and into the air could be modified. They could sequester, they could do all sorts of stuff with it. There were some chemicals they were having a rough time dealing with. So new technologies had to come online to deal with some of the more nastier chemicals. So armed with new legislation coming out of the federal government and the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency, the focus was to clean up industry and municipalities and limit to what they can dump into rivers, into landfills, or put into the air. And in most cases, industry came around, so to speak, and began to really actually clean up their act. Municipalities were having a rougher time, but eventually they would come around. And by the mid-70s, things were looking pretty good. Now, climate scientists had been working since the 50s on trying to understand climate and trying to understand the mechanisms that were going on in the atmosphere. And they were discovering that the Earth has been warming since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And they began to identify various chemicals and, you know, problems. Of course, other scientists have been working on other issues with the environment, environmental scientists, and they were making a number of startling discoveries. So by the 1970s, early 80s, a number of chemicals were being had been identified and had been phased out that had caused serious climate issues and health issues. The removal of lead from gasoline, elimination of sulfur dioxide. All these chemicals were contributing to health issues, as in the lead in gasoline and the SO2 creating acid rain. And then with the refrigerants being a issue that was causing a depletion of the ozone layer, which was, again, another important discovery, that the ozone that had blocked ultraviolet rays was being depleted by these various common refrigerants. So, of course, industry came around, I guess, came up with new refrigerants, new products to deal with these issues. But in this case, there were some costs involved. And then there was the major push to reduce VOCs. These were, again, hydrocarbons that were being released during normal operation. And actually, when I first got into the industry, many of my projects was to reduce VOC emissions in many facilities. Now, in many cases, the upfront costs to the industry was fairly expensive. But interestingly enough, by reducing what was being put into the rivers, into the air, into the landfills, meant more product that could be sold. as product as opposed to having to pay someone to carry it off your site. And oddly enough, this was actually a money-making a deal for many of these industries. Some of the hardest hit by environmental legislation had been the oil industries, but as you can tell, they're not hurting for money. So any thought that environmental laws are too expensive and is costing these companies all this money, that is all, it's all make believe and a fantasy talk. So then there's still been pushes to eliminate various chemicals. SO2 has been a big one, and the removal of sulfur from diesel fuel and so on. And all these regulations, of course, is helping the environment. Now the big push is now carbon output, mostly carbon dioxide, and this seems to be the stickler point for the denialists. Now, when I looked into the claims of the denialists and trying to find, is there one person like in the HIV denial, there was at least three main players who had promoted that HIV was non-existent or not what was being claimed. So I went to look for any these scientists who had been taking this stance, and oddly enough, I couldn't find any. And when I did find them, I found that they were actually paid to create papers to say that global warming, global climate change was not happening. And when I did look for the main proponents of climate change denial, the list was also pretty interesting. The major climate change denialists have been Donald Trump, who is a real estate mogul, Ted Nugent, rock star slash gun advocate, James Inhofe, who has been is a senator from Oklahoma, Michael Crichton, who is famous for many of the science-based fiction, and a number of weather forecasters and architects have been pretty vocal on climate change. I think one of the more famous ones is John Coleman, who is the Weather Channel, who had also been a weather reporter on Chicago News. So there was very few scientists making the claim of that there is climate change happening. And the ones that are have been paid to say that climate change isn't happening or it's not what everyone is saying. They've argued against the hockey stick. Now, the hockey stick is a graph of global temperatures derived from various sources, from everything from weather local temperature readings from across the globe, tree ring analysis, ice ring analysis, and this picture emerged where the Earth had been cooling steadily for 100,000 years or so, and then roughly about 200 years ago, there was this sharp uptick, pretty much coinciding with the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And of course, the scientists attacked it as various excuses, faulty correlations. Tree ring is not accurate. The ice layers accuracy, all that kind of stuff. And this argument was bought and paid for by a couple of industrial entities. First, you have API. This is the American Petroleum Institute. Now, the American Petroleum Institute is this organization that is a society, I guess, or along that lines, that have studied and has created a wealth of knowledge for people in the petroleum industry and has done various studies. I mean, it's a very important collection of information for people in the industry to use. Many of the standards I work from in the oil industry has come from API. But API is not just a standards operator. corporation, but it is a lobbying group also for the petroleum industry. And of course, and this is actually kind of a general statement about industry, is it's always been their goal is to lower costs and produce a better product. That is the basis for any type of industrial or even commercial work. You are, if you're a small company or a large company, you're looking to make the most money by holding your costs down, if you can produce a decent product or even a high quality product, and of course being able to sell it at a good price. This is a goal of any industry, anybody who is involved with some type of product. So when the members of API see regulation coming down, depending on their particular attitude toward this, it generally seems that they do see that there's going to be a heavy upfront cost to implement this particular piece of legislation and try to meet the whatever goals that are being set by the legislation. And of course, it's safe to say that somebody is going to say, no, this isn't going to work, or this is too expensive, or whatever. And that's legitimate. I mean, that's something that happens all the time, you know, depending on where you're at, whatever industry you're involved with. I mean, I've heard about arguments in the dairy industry about how licenses are issued and small farmers cannot afford to get the proper licenses to do what they want to do. That's an issue unto itself, but especially with the petroleum industry and really any type of power generating, especially the coal or gas industries, the push to reduce various emissions are actually, I'm not 100% sure if they're kind of reaching that point where the law of diminishing returns, as you're trying to deal with less and less, the costs go higher and higher and higher. So this may be, again, what they're seeing or what they're basing their decisions on. But API did pay scientists to create these denial papers when they would speak, claim that climate change wasn't happening. And ultimately, they did get caught doing that and got into a little bit of trouble. Since then, API has not taken any stand on climate change, but they've still are the counterweight to the more radical environmental laws that may be coming up. Now, the second player in this denial game had been Exxon Petroleum. Now, they also had pressed the idea and may have been one of the main promoters of API's efforts to create doubt in the climate change discussions. And this makes a lot of sense to me. And again, I can't get into too many details, but Exxon had been a major antagonist within the petroleum industry. Early on, there was a number of serious industrial accidents. Bhopal, which was a major disaster for the chemical industry in general, but a number of refinery fires. It became necessary to establish a set of guidelines on operation. This would eventually congeal into the process safety management laws and additional laws being created under the Occupational Health and Safety Act basically the OSHA laws. The idea was to eliminate, there was a number of issues going on within the chemical industry. A lot of practices that were not safe, and oddly enough, if even the simplest procedures were followed, many of these accidents would never have happened. So the idea was to codify and to create a framework so that Congress would eventually approve this, the various process safety management rules. And all the major petroleum producers in the United States back this legislation, except for Exxon. Now, this is before it became ExxonMobil, so the this is not the current incarnation of the company, but you would actually see this basic attitude within Exxon. And as you can see from before the merger, and as you can see before the ExxonMobil merger, Exxon had a very poor environmental record, and the last major oil spill attributed to Exxon was the Exxon Valdez, when it ran aground in Alaska and damaged the Alaskan coastline. And the third player, and this is the important one, has been the Koch brothers. These are the guys that own Koch Industries. They're a major chemical and petrochemical operation, and they have spent billions of dollars to fight global warming legislation and regulation. The Koch brothers are a major player in the financing of a number of Republican senators. They've also supported Libertarian candidates and actually attempted to get a Libertarian president elected. The exact numbers, I'm not sure, but the last time I looked, roughly about $2.5 billion of their money has been pumped into various campaigns across the country. And to date, these are guys who probably about the worst of the worst. They operate a number of large refineries. All of them have had numerous environmental incidences, which include about 300 oil spills within their sphere of influence. They've paid $63 million in fines for all these environmental accidents. So what is this climate denial? What is going on here? Well, this is not a question. The climate denial, there's nothing behind it. I can't find any solid science that contradicts that the climate is changing, that the climate isn't changing. I can't find any science saying that the climate isn't changing. Most of the science is tainted because it's been bought and paid for. And it's hard to me, the credibility of those scientists who have made these claims, and these scientists have been involved with U.S. policy, that the idea that there is no climate change happening, it's hard to, if I had, you know, to weigh out real science versus this science, the real science is going to win out. And the fact of the matter is, the Earth is warming, and it's us. So this climate change denial is a attempt to create doubt amongst the American people whether or not it's really happening. Mostly because, well, it's a combination of creating doubt that it's happening and creating the fear that the implementation of regulations is going to cost the American people more money. And I'll get into that here in a little bit more detailed. Now, depending on who you're listening to or talking, you know, the ideas that's being thrown about how to deal with this climate change, you kind of get two kind of diametrically opposed ideas. Of course, you got the Republicans and the Libertarians who are claiming it's not happening and we don't want regulation. The Libertarians actually want to get rid of much of the regulations governing the environmental protection. I'm not 100% sure if they want to eliminate the Environmental Protection Agency, but I think this is probably a number of those things. This is kind of a libertarian ideal. Not all, but a lot of them have. They're just opposed. You know, there's this element there that is opposed to regulations. The Republicans, they have no problem regulating as long as it means their buddies get their industrial buddies make a profit. So you've got that side who wants nothing done, and then of course on the other side with the Democrats, they want to in effect either shut down all the dirty industries, coal, gas, and so on, and switch over to renewable fuels, which is a good idea, but the renewables are not really in a position to take up the slack if we did eliminate coal, gas, oil. Of course, there's the third option, is one that I kind of adhere to, is that I see this as an opportunity for industry to put its weight, its R&D money, into leveraging existing technologies to clean up what they're doing. Now, I'm aware of a few technologies that are being worked on now that may actually reuse loose carbon. Okay, there's a lot of technologies out there that can, where you can sequester, you can reuse the spent carbons and so on. There's all sorts of neat little things that could be done. And quite frankly, I think if they could be leveraged and could be made economical, we would never have to get rid of coal or gasoline or anything. There might be some additional costs involved. All has to do with the energy conservation stuff. And it's right now, it looks promising. I think it could be done. I think it's just an issue of it'll come down to costs and whether or not they can pull it off or not. But I think there's opportunities there for industry to, instead of spending billions of dollars like the Koch brothers have in trying to fight legislation, that $2 billion could have easily got pumped into into R&D work to come up with new technologies where they would not be emitting the carbon, especially carbon dioxide, they are now. And quite frankly, if they would place the effort that they have buying Congress into producing products that are the production of them are environmentally friendly, we may be light years ahead, and these would be technologies that could be leased to everyone. I know of a number of companies that do. They develop processes and they lease it to refineries. This is a very lucrative business. And if a Koch brothers were to work with a company to develop, cleaner production of gasoline, diesel, kerosene, all the fuels that we use, or being able to clean up coal, which can be done, this would mean much more product for them. They could sell more, make more money, and of course, selling that technology or leasing that technology to other refineries is quite a lucrative. Would be very lucrative for the Americans. But of course, these guys don't see past their ledger sheets. So to kind of conclude and wrap this thing up, first of all, global warming, global cooling, global climate change, it's happening. It is happening. We've got the evidence. The science is solid on this. I mean, if you follow any type of, if you do follow the science and that, heck, even John Oliver on HBO, 99% of all climate scientists are in agreement that global climate change is happening. There's a clear line of evidence. Nothing much to argue there. The problem has been policy. When I was researching this, there was a show called Skeptico. Alex Sakiris, he had an interview with two climate scientists. I think this all seemed to be all about denialism. Apparently, Alex is arguing that climate change isn't happening. He's clear. He believes that the science is wrong. He's never been right on anything anyhow, but I don't know why I listened to it other than it said climate change debate. And when I was listening to his show, what came out very clear was Alex didn't really care about the science. It was going to be the policy to reverse this change. And it had, one of the tools of this was going to be carbon trading, carbon credits, carbon tax. If I'm not mistaken, Europe is now working with a carbon tax system. I don't know what they're doing. There's definitely, I know that there is carbon sequestering. There's carbon credits, offsets, all this kind of stuff. All these different schemes being used right now. And anytime, if here in the United States, when you say tax, we're going to tax carbon, that means somebody is going to have to pay, and that usually means the little guy, the guy at the end of the line, the guy that has to buy the tank of gas, or the airline that has to pump the jet fuel, or the trucker that has to pump it into their tanks, or the fuel oil, or the whatever fuel you're using to heat your home, motivate your cars, run your lawnmowers, and that you're going to eventually pay something. It's going to be paying more, and this bothers Americans. This is the real problem. We don't want to pay more taxes. We just don't like it. We'll argue it. The unfortunate reality here is we might have to, and if we keep going the way we're going, instead of being possible, it might be for real. A carbon tax only hurts the little guy. The producers of the gasoline only, you know, if they're forced to pay a tax, that just gets tacked on to their cost of business, and it gets passed on to the consumer. Don't believe it when they say, oh, it's only for the producer, or it's only for the industrial user. That cost has to go somewhere, and you're going to pay for it. And that's what really happens, and that's why Americans are up in arms over these carbon taxes. The thing is, this carbon tax isn't a tax. It isn't money. It is trading in carbon. It's all paid in carbon. It's exchanged in carbon. It's actually all paper. There is no physical change or exchange of anything. It's just you're allowed, the idea is you're allowed so much carbon output, you need to find a way to offset that carbon. I don't understand all the schemes, but it seems like what it is to get to a carbon neutral situation, which means planting forests, perhaps switching to renewable fuels. There's all sorts of methods. Even though you're producing gasoline, you could run your company vehicles off of biofuels. There's nothing, you know, there's all sorts of things that everyone can do. But it does seem to be there's going to be some costs involved, especially early on, because the technology isn't robust yet enough to support that. So the idea that the carbon tax, I mean, that's what bothers Americans. And this is really why Americans are all up in arms over this. And there's a lot of untruth to it. There's not a lot of substance to it. I think the real problem, and one of the problems we're going to be facing, is the political fallout of climate change. So again, to try to wrap this discussion up, the problem isn't that climate change isn't happening. It's happening. I think we need to deal with this as a problem. We can deal with it by denying it happening, climate denial, or we could take proactive steps to slow it down, stop it, reverse it, because it's going to be important down the road. There have been a number of predictions, and predictions of the future is very, I'm going to say unreliable, but there's definitely going to be some changes. We're already experiencing changes such as numerous tropical diseases are now finding their way further north because of the temperatures that they live at are now moving steadily north. Diseases that normally would have been found in the Caribbean, the equatorial zones around Central and South America have now found their way into the United States. Increasing numbers of people coming down with dengue fever, a tropical disease. You're also seeing bizarre weather, much more extreme weather as of late. When I was growing up, Illinois, Iowa, Indiana, we would get a tornado or two a year. Now, those tornadoes are happening further south in Tennessee, Alabama, Mississippi, and they're much more violent. Whether this is going to be the result of climate change, and whether they are climate change, that's to be said, but it is certainly, we're seeing some varying weather patterns. And if these patterns change, we may find ourselves dealing with serious droughts or too much rain, all sorts of different scenarios. I don't know if any, as far as the future predictions seems to point to just the general extremes. So it's going to be, it could be pretty dangerous for crops and food production. Already the military has commissioned a number of reports and have determined that global climate change, if it keeps going the way it does, will create new tensions in the globe and possibly increased riots, wars, and so on. So whether this plays out or not, it's hard to say. Making predictions along that lines, it's so there's too many variables to deal with. But you know, we are going to be dealing with some serious problems, and we need to start thinking about them, at least thinking about them today, or at least trying to come up with solutions. Certainly, I've seen companies like Google are experimenting with ideas about reversing some of the effects of global warming. So the idea here is that we need to really, we really need to look at this seriously. We need to understand, and we need to make it clear to those who do adhere to climate denial or climate change denial that they're wrong. They're just plain wrong, and that we need to look at it now. I'm kind of optimistic. I think we do have the ability to develop technologies to mitigate, perhaps if anything, at least to halt it. Whether or not it can reverse it, that's another question. But we certainly need to be looking at new ways of powering our societies, or at least do it with much more efficiencies, which is, again, that is in tune with, capitalism, actually. So the reality is, global climate change is real. So the reality is global climate change is real. It is happening. We're basically being a line of BS to fight it. And this line of BS has no basis in truth or even reality. And all it does is benefit the billionaire brothers, the Koch brothers.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
So for some announcements, first of all, I'm back. I took a little extended time off, partially because I had medical problem with my jaw. Apparently a chunk of bone decided to break loose and got infected and tried to work its way out. After a few weeks, it finally came out and everything was fine. And about that time, I did have some personal stuff happening with my family. So I took some time for that and kind of took a little breather on top of it. So, hopefully that's over with, and I'm going to be back to a regular schedule here pretty quick. And I did get a comment a while back, kind of holding me to task on bias. I did a report on the Republicans' belief that there's a conspiracy that Obama was handing away the internet to foreign interests, and the possibility of security issues associated with that. And the listener was not, he was kind of taken aback, I guess. It's hard to say, that I was critical of the Republicans. Well, when I explained to him that the story was clearly the Republicans claiming conspiracy, there's not much I can do with the facts. I pointed this out because this came up in the news. It was one of my news programs where my conspiracy in the news. And so there's not much, I can't change the facts that the Republicans have claimed this conspiracy. And of course I pointed it out to the listener, and they also explained that, I'm not going to change a story to make it sound better than it really is. Now, I have no love for any of the political parties in the United States. I find issues with all the parties, and if you actually listen to me on the BitchSpot report, you probably heard some of these. And actually, in this show, I also kind of called out the libertarians because they actually were part of this denialism. Oddly enough, they don't even make any excuses for it. They're opposed to regulation. They want to roll back regulations. They want to eliminate a lot of things, which on the face, it's great. No more taxes, elimination of various regulatory agencies. I find problems with that, where especially in regulations, because much of our industry, if they were allowed to do what they wanted to do, they would do it. It's going to take regulation to deter these activities, especially with the environment. If a company could get away with it, they would dump toxic waste right into your backyard if they can get away with it. That's where I see the importance of regulation. Now, some regulations may seem silly, but you know what? There's a reason for it. I think this idea of going back to the unregulated industries, I think is a very dangerous. We've already seen the danger of deregulation within the banking and the meltdown in 2008, 2009 is attributed to deregulation. So, like I said, I have very little love for any of the parties. Now, if the Democrats were claiming a conspiracy, I'd be more than happy to report that. Certainly, I could probably even point out that the Libertarians are heavily involved in 9/11, the 9/11 conspiracy. But this is not in those cases, especially like with 9/11. 9/11 seems to be a equal opportunity conspiracy. All political beliefs are thrown into this mess. Certainly, I can, when I talked about the Obama birth certificate, this is clearly driven by the conservatives. And these are the ultra-conservative types who are, especially guys like Jerome Corsi. I've mentioned him. He's very active in creating conspiracies out of nothing. So, again, while there may be times where I may seem biased in the story, it's not necessarily true. A lot of times there's groups who are actively promoting these conspiracies. Alex Jones, I don't know what his political affiliations are, because I hear everything from paleoconservative to libertarian to ultra-conservative, conservative Republican. He's all across the board. No one really knows what he is, and probably Alex Jones doesn't know what he is. Sometimes he claims to be a constitutionalist. I think he's done that, but he's certainly in the left field there, or right field, or whatever field that falls into. It's hard to say, but I think most conspiracies do cut across various political frames of belief, and I don't single them out unless they're the ones that are claiming conspiracy. So that will wrap it up for this episode. I'm going to be doing Holocaust denial as part of this series, and hopefully that'll be out in 2 weeks or 2 weeks after you hear this. So thank you for listening, and thank you for hanging on, and all the well wishes you've given me while I was gone. Everything's great now. I just gotta stick to my schedule, and I think I can be back with you in 2 weeks. Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's mikebohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.